Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Coal country is in the midst of a historic transition. Communities that have built their cultures and economies around coal face a future without it. It's not a future most coal communities would have chosen, and because of the economic shock of the coronavirus pandemic, it's happened much sooner than anticipated. And instead of a glide path of a decade or more to diversify from the economic base of coal, communities in coal country may see that foundation erode in just a few years. So how can people who've been left behind make a decent living? That's a focus of what began as the Kentucky Environmental Foundation and has evolved into a Lexington-based nonprofit called LIKEN. It's an acronym for Livelihoods Knowledge Exchange Network. Betsy Taylor is its executive director. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Betsy.
Oh, thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here after being an ardent fan of WEKU and Eastern Standard for many years.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. And for anybody interested in getting the full story and scope of what LIKEN is about and does, I suggest they go to the website, which is LIKEN, that's L-I-K-E-N, knowledge.org. Now, we want to focus the time that we have with you on an effort you have underway to gauge the prospects for agroforestry or forest farming in central Appalachia. First, tell us, what is agroforestry?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And I should be clear that we're working with this terrific team of folks who have very deep knowledge, and it's a very interdisciplinary team. And I am speaking as the person who's kind of coordinating this. So I'm going to, in many ways, channel their wisdom. I consider this a kind of journalistic karaoke, but I'm speaking for a really impressive team. And agroforestry brings together agriculture and forestry, but in a really unique and effective way that's particularly important in the 21st century. So sometimes when people think about forestry, they think, oh, it's about how many board feet of timber can we get out? And in thinking about farming, a lot of our models for farming are kind of dominated by models that have come out of the Midwest. So people think about farming more as sort of a two-dimensional thing. It's kind of, you know, you're planning a ranch house and you're thinking about how to lay things out on the ground. But what forest farming does is to look at the whole architecture of natural forests and thinks of them as having kind of four stories, each of which can produce different kinds of products. And so that's really the heart of agroforestry, because you think in terms of what can grow on the floor of the forest, what can grow at the shrub level, what can grow sort of mid-level, and then finally, what's at the canopy. And so that's really the power of agroforestry, especially in areas where you have a lot of natural assets like you do in Central Appalachia, because we have this incredible native forest that many people nationally just aren't aware of what a gem we have here. It's a really unique forest.
I know that you're in the process of getting out there, you and your partners, and gathering information for this initiative. What sorts of information are you in the process of pulling together?
We're starting with a project that was actually funded by the National Agroforestry Center, which is under the USDA. So it's national. And we got a grant from them to really focus on Central Appalachia, on its unique ecological assets in the forest, but also the particular developmental needs in Central Appalachia, especially in areas where there's been a lot of coal production. And so we've been focusing primarily on West Virginia, working with a soil scientist at WVU, graduate student Chris Burney, who's also directing the project, and then a wonderful professor at Virginia Tech, Dr. Tom Hammett, who's really an international expert in non-timber forest products. And then Dr. Mary Hufford, who's on our lichen team, who's a folklorist of the forest. So she's really capturing the cultural knowledge and the traditional knowledge that is also so rich in our area. And so with this grant, we've been focusing on really listening to emerging success stories that are coming up, particular farms or small businesses where people are including at least some aspects of full-blown agroforestry. So we can listen to what's already working and documenting that, and then also looking at the kind of support systems that those folks find most useful. And then we're going to turn that into some educational materials for the National Agroforestry Center, which will then be on their website. And so at this point, it's very much a listening project to listen to the exciting things that are coming up. And we're very eager to shift our attention next year to Kentucky.
Betsy, what sorts of examples of successful agroforestry operations are you finding out there?
Yes. One person named Ruby Daniels has started a thriving herbal and forest botanicals business just north of Beckley, West Virginia. And folks can actually find that. She named the business after her grandmother, who taught her much of her healing and herbal lore. So you can find it at www.creasyjane.com. That's C-R-E-A-S-Y, Jane.com. And in many ways, this project exemplifies some of the key goals of our project, because Ruby comes from four generations of a coal mining family. And as happens so often in coal mining communities, her parents actually left to find work in Maryland, but every summer she'd come back and visit her grandmother. And so she was deeply attached to the family land. And she learned a lot of traditional knowledge from her grandmother, who carried on long, multi-generational Afro-Latian traditions of herbs, gardening, forestry, and healing. Ruby went on, she got a bachelor's at Towson University and a master's, but she decided to return to West Virginia. So we see this as just a really important example of a way in which one can hold on to the youth of the region and find a way for them to both come back and make, you know, develop a livelihood that has a lot of meaning to them, but also build on the culture and the assets of the region. And she's also, you know, coupling the traditional knowledge that she carries with research. So she's researching archaeology and oral histories about, say, the practices that were carried on within enslaved communities. And her plot of land there, it's not a large plot of land, and it's actually in heirs property. It was passed down in the family. So the key idea in agroforestry is that it takes a while, especially in land like this, it's impacted by coal mining and also it's near a coal camp. So the land has, you know, it's been stressed. And so it takes a while to kind of build out the whole sort of forest architecture that you need. So she started with some high value plants that grow low in the ground, that she knew she'd have a market for. And so that's things like lavender, chamomile, lemon balm, calendula, skullcap, rose petals, and then blackberries. And the whole model here is that you start going step by step, having a business plan that gives you enough income to build up at one story of the forest. And so she's producing some high value-added products now with teas, soaps, cosmetics, and body care, and has been very effective at retailing her products.
Betsy, environment and economic interest have long been and are still often at odds. Do you think it's possible to combine good livelihoods with environmental sustainability?
Absolutely. And the big challenge is to is to have really trusting partnerships and support systems so that people can do the kind of long-term planning that's often required to both build up their economic base, but especially in something like agroforestry, to also really regenerate the land and care for it. So I think we need to do much more than we are doing to give people really practical, hands-on, scientific, but really useful advice as they go about doing the kind of work that that Ruby's doing. And so because she's working with these soil scientists, you know, she's figuring out how to bring the soil back, and that means that she will be able to start planting nut and fruit trees that's just on the way. And then she wants to model how to do triple bottom line accounting on the work she's doing. So I think it's going to take a whole web of partnerships to pull this off. Now, just to be clear, agroforestry is not going to completely solve all the problems in the region. But I think.
No, it's one path of many that
exactly.
But let me ask you: you have the study underway, and I realize that the pandemic has thrown all kinds of obstacles in all of our paths. But do you have something of a timeline when you expect to complete the study of the prospects for forest farming in the mountain region?
Yes, and again, this will be mostly focused on West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And by the end of this summer, we will have completed our case studies. And then in September, we'll be completing some of the modeling, the sort of scenarios. And by December, we will have all of the materials pulled together to showcase the successes, demonstrate what was required to, you know, to have those successes. Mm-hmm. And then what we will not be able to do by December of this year is to be able to extrapolate from that to wider areas, to say something like across 24 counties in this area, how many livelihoods might be possible in agroforestry. That's going to take us another year. It's going to take a lot more on the ground work to ground truth those sort of overview estimates, if that makes sense.
Sure. Makes perfect sense. And I know these things take time and anything can happen, so it can be delayed. But I'd like to check back with you later in the year just to see where it stands, if I may.
That would be wonderful.
All right. Betsy Taylor is Executive Director of LIKEN, Livelihoods Knowledge Exchange Network. Thank you so much, Betsy.
Thank you, Tom.
On our April 22nd show, we talked about efforts to restore the forests of eastern Kentucky that were lost to surface mining. We talked with Michael French of Green Forest Work, a nonprofit organized to carry out reforestation in the region, and Patrick Angel about his vision of reviving the sheep industry that once thrived in Appalachia. So now we're going to connect more dots, and joining us is Zach Foster, director of the Appalachian Conservation Corps. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
And first, Zach, let's talk about the concept of National Service Corps in general. Talk to us about that.
Sure, yeah. So the Appalachian Conservation Corps is a program of conservation legacy, which is a large family of conservation corps that are modeled after the Civilian Conservation Corps from back in the 30s. And the concept that we've grown out of that history is the idea to connect youth and young adults to impactful service opportunities in their communities, in their region, and across the country on all sorts of work that include conservation, natural disaster response, and other types of community service.
And so the Appalachian Conservation Corps covers a pretty broad swath of the eastern part of the United States. Is that correct? It's not just the Appalachia that we think of in eastern Kentucky and West Virginia.
Yeah, that's right. So we actually work, we have two offices right now, one based in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and the second in Beckley, West Virginia. But our program serves Kentucky, when we're working with partners there and in partnership with the Southeast Conservation Corps. But our big base of operations is Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, parts of Maryland, and Ohio, pretty much anywhere where there's coal impact or public lands to do work on.
Okay, tell us what you do. What does the Corps get out there and do?
It's a lot. Honestly, I think the kind of work that we're most excited to dig into is traditional trail construction and maintenance to improve outdoor recreational access for both hikers, hunters, and bikers. We do reforestation, forest management, and ecological restoration. We also serve with folks like the National Park Service on non-native invasive species control, as well as historical restoration. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we actually tag in on natural disaster response. An example of that would be to send our crews in after a hurricane or a flooding disaster, or in the case of the current situation, a pandemic, where we might support local vaccination efforts.
In the introduction, I mentioned Green Forest work and Patrick Angel's sheep project. How does your work connect with those efforts?
It's a really great relationship that we've been building. What the Appalachian Conservation Corps is really good for, and actually just the core model in general, is bringing youth and young adults to an opportunity to serve and learn. And so what both of those organizations are doing are taking science, history, and a vision for the future and trying to chart a new path for communities. What our part in that is leveraging the passion, the drive, and honestly, the hunger for new opportunities that young adults have in the region to provide the power to get that work done and to push those missions forward in the community. So specifically, we send crews out to work with Green Forest work doing spruce restoration, where we're actually doing selective thinning around spruce sites with chainsaw crews. We're doing selective herbicide application to remove non-native invasive species that are competing with plantings. And then we're also just helping restore healthy habitat on formerly mined sites. And then with the shepherding project, with Patrick Angel's project, that one is further out, and it's one that I'm just really excited to be a community ally for and to hopefully bring that new career path to young adults.
As I understand it, Zach, there are plans in the making for Kentucky. You've mentioned Brenna Kelly. Tell me a little bit more about Brenna and what she's going to bring to the table.
You know, the guiding mission to Conservation Legacy is local first. And in this case, Brenna Kelly is the director of the Southeast Conservation Corps, who's currently based in Chattanooga, Tennessee, but she's actually from Kentucky and has been pushing to build a Conservation Corps based in the state to really serve the state's needs specifically. It's really hard to stand up a Conservation Corps. It requires really challenging funding streams. We touch every federal and state bureaucracy that operates on public lands. And so right now, Brenna is doing the hard work of building the relationships to bring that together. But even this year, we're standing up field projects in the state, and I wouldn't be surprised to start seeing more pop up in the coming 2 years.
If the idea of this kind of work appeals to somebody that's listening to us right now, what kind of skills are required?
Not much, to be totally transparent. You know, honestly, what I'm more excited about is somebody who's curious, who's excited to learn, and has a service ethic. Outside of that, we train the rest. We have a spectrum of opportunities that can meet folks where they're at. If you're a 16-year-old who's never had a job before, you know, come join one of our youth crews and we'll teach you valuable job skills. We'll even help you get your first pair of boots and you'll go out and do trail work on the national forest. If you're, you just wrapped up your master's degree, you're 23 years old and looking for a way to really spread your technical wings, we've got opportunities to serve as a geoscientist in the parks or do GIS work with the National Park Service on really advanced remote sensing projects, let's say guiding habitat management practices for the Park Service. So I think, you know, when I say that we're there to create opportunities, I mean it's there for everybody, regardless of your background, what community you're from, or what your goals are moving forward. We work really hard to create a service opportunity for anybody that's hungry for one.
Well, I grew up in the Daniel Boone National Forest in Rowan County, and we tramped around those woods forever. And so when I hear of something like this, I tend to get excited. And I hope I'm not being overly optimistic here, but do I sense that there's some momentum behind reforestation in our region?
I think you're being optimistic and realistic, which I appreciate. There is momentum around reforestation. I think also if you look at it from a wider angle lens, the concept of ecological restoration and valuing our landscape as a resource is one that's really taken root, not only in the conservation community, but, you know, honestly, in the political climate right now as well. We're seeing really great initiatives coming down for the Civilian Climate Corps, We're also seeing a new emphasis placed on creating opportunities for folks who are recovering from a post-coal economy. And right now, those two things are coming together to create a shared focus on new workforce development, but also just improving our shared public lands. And so, yes, I think that folks will see reforestation. They will see really concerted habitat improvement projects. And they're also going to see a focus on improving recreational access. So the ability to get out on trails that can serve folks who maybe are new to the outdoors. I think that one thing that I've really seen, I'm not sure about in your local area, but around here, our trailheads have blown up with new users who've never been out to hike, but it's a free, healthy thing to do with friends and family outside. And even once this pandemic moves on, I think that folks are going to remember that as something they'd like to share with their kids. And that all takes a toll and that all takes work. And so, yes, I think it's there. And I'm just really proud to be part of an organization that's able to be there to help push that forward.
Well, going back to getting involved with your organization, what's required of those who apply?
So the application process is really simple. It's all online. And for folks that might not have reliable internet access, we're willing to create an opportunity to apply either over the phone. We can help find resources to get through. But for requirement, honestly, as long as somebody is within the age bracket with that we're working with, so 16 to 18 for our youth crews, and then 18 to 30 plus for our AmeriCorps crews, and they're legally permitted to work in the United States, then we're good to go. And from there, it's just a matter of sitting down for an interview and learning what kind of opportunities folks are interested in. But like I said, we just have such a diversity of opportunities, and there's going to be more in the future that we're really throwing the doors wide open as we can at this point.
So, Zach, what gets you out the door in the morning? What do you enjoy most about this work?
I'm glad you asked that, because it's a story similar to yours, actually, having grown up in the outdoors. I grew up here just outside of Harrisonburg, Virginia, really interested in the outdoors as a kid, always had read books like A River Runs Through It, and this idea of like this romantic notion for working with the Forest Service always appealed to me. But back then, there wasn't an opportunity like a conservation corps that I could join. And so I was really fortunate to have mentors in my high school who helped kind of guide me towards that path. And I was fortunate to be able to go to a college that gave me some opportunities. But that doesn't exist for everybody. And so I was able to travel the West doing seasonal work and work for a few other corps and agencies in the years afterward. But eventually moved back to where I'm from. I mean, it's the landscape that you all are familiar with draws people back. And so I came home and wanted to see that opportunity in the community that I grew up in. And so with the partnership of Conservation Legacy, was able to stand this program up in 2016. And honestly, I wake up hungry for that every day. The work is challenging, but the fact that at the end of the day, I can go out and look at these crews who are out there dirty, sweaty, tired, cold, dodging lightning storms, but doing work that they are proud of, and they're going to come back in 20 years and show their kids. I mean, I can't complain about that. That's a gift. And so that's what gets me up in the morning.
Sounds great. I hope we've inspired somebody here. That's Zach Foster. He's director of the Appalachian Conservation Corps. Thank you so much, Zach.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Coming full circle back to coal and our sources of energy, solar energy is slowly making headway in the Ohio Valley. Liam Niemeyer of the Ohio Valley Resource reported recently that Clark County, for instance, already has one solar installation, 32,300 solar panels on 60 acres, with much larger solar farms under consideration. For a community in the Bluegrass region that values farmland as a key part of its identity, the solar industry knocking on its door presents opportunity, but also raises concerns about future land use. And Katie Myers reports that solar advocates are hoping to change more than just how people get electricity. They want to change the balance of power between customers and utilities as well.
How many do we have up there? 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
Erin Bottomley directs St. Vincent's Mission, serving hundreds of hungry people in Floyd County, Kentucky. She's pointing out the solar panels that have allowed them to reduce overhead costs and focus on community service.
27 panels on top, and that runs the volunteer house, the home repair garage, woodworking shop, and our RV pad.
With solar, St. Vincent's Mission saw its bills drop from $250 per month to $15. That's because of net metering credits. These credits help make solar affordable. Selling clean energy back to the grid pays for the installation costs. That may change with a proposal before the state's Public Service Commission that would reduce net metering payments, cutting the value of new solar installations by up to 80%. And that could hurt a lot of people, says Kara Cooper of the Kentucky Solar Advocacy Network.
We find tons of small businesses. We find tons of nonprofits. We find a lot of people who are on fixed incomes who are choosing rooftop solar.
Cooper has been organizing opposition to the move, which was proposed by investor-backed utility Kentucky Power. In January, Kentucky Power asked the commission to approve this change, along with a rate hike of 11%. A 2019 bill made this possible, allowing Kentucky utilities and the commission to set net metering rates. The commission is set to hear the issue in May. Kentucky Power did not respond to a request for comment. Next door in Ohio, solar is booming. At least in some forms. Policymakers there are encouraging some large-scale solar, but not rooftop solar, which Ohio utilities have attempted to fight in the past.
They're a little bit more okay with renewables if they own and operate those systems, right?
That's Gilbert Michaud, an energy policy analyst at Ohio University.
They're okay with, hey, we're going to build a big wind farm, or hey, we're going to build a big solar farm, because we are owning and operating the system. That is still sort of within the purview of our monopolistic control over pieces of the market, right?
Michaud says most utilities prefer large-scale clean energy. Large solar farms directly feed the grid without loss of revenue. In some cases, those installations are owned by corporations that have renewable energy goals, like Amazon. That business imperative is even helping solar grow in coal-heavy West Virginia, where some lawmakers see all scales of solar as linked to economic growth. West Virginia's legislature has now voted to expand funding and protection for solar 2 years in a row, supported by key Republicans who say clean energy is big business. But for Kara Cooper, decentralized solar power means something different. Political power for utility customers. Cooper sees solar as part of a bigger strategy, which she calls energy democracy.
How can we engage with the Public Service Commission? How can we educate people about the role that we can play in that process? And how can we give everyday folks more of a voice in the decision-making around our electricity?
Back at St. Vincent's Mission, Bottomley looks forward to using freed-up funds to bolster their community programs.
Yeah, we want to do services that help people come out of poverty, not just support people while they're in poverty.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Katie Myers in Floyd County, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource gets support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and WEKU. Coming up after the break, how strip mining almost didn't happen, and an information lifeline for Kentucky small businesses. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, Lexington's Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning will present virtual readings from Lisa Cross Smith's This Close to OK, Karen McElmurray's Wanting Radiance, and Alex Harrow's The Once and Future Witches, Tuesday, May 18th. For more information, visit the Carnegie Center's website, carnegiecenterlex.org. And in Danville, the exhibit New Birth, New Growth, New Beginnings runs through May 29th at Art Center of the Bluegrass. Artwork in the exhibit echoes the themes of spring. For more information and gallery hours, visit artcenterky.org. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
You don't need me to tell you that the coal story is complicated. We know that mining it and selling it kept roofs over the heads of many and enriched a few, while powering the country, even as it fouled air and water with heavy metals and other toxins. It paid for schools and hospitals that educated and treated miners with black lung disease. So, complicated. Stephanie Lang, editor of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, looks at an important side of this many-faceted story, the opposition.
Chad Montry is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He is the author of To Save the Land and People, A History of Opposition to Surface Coal Mining in Appalachia, and more recently, The Myth of Silent Spring, Rethinking the Origins of American Environmentalism. He is also a former Register of the Kentucky Historical Society Editorial Advisory Board member, and I'm really excited to speak with him today. Let's focus a little bit on your book, To Save the Land and People, which focuses on 20th century movement to outlaw surface coal mining in Appalachia. The book certainly tackles very important themes in Appalachian history, not only reactions to environmental abuses, destruction of property, and certainly human health, but also issues surrounding working class activism, poverty, and the complicated tradition of private property. And within that, certainly throughout Eastern Kentucky, the troubled tradition of absentee land ownership. Surface coal mining, or more commonly strip mining, really takes a hold in Eastern Kentucky in the 60s and 70s, as your book shows. And this, of course, followed decades of underground mining that employed different technologies associated with that type of mineral extraction. So tell us a little bit about surface mining in the 1960s and 1970s in Appalachia. What were the issues local residents faced? And along with groups like Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, who were some of the groups working with local communities?
Well, it's good that you mentioned the 1960s. And in fact, you know, I mentioned in the book that even the 1940s and 1950s, because there's a big story that happens, you know, well before Kentuckians for the Commonwealth was established. And this is a result of the coal industry and coal companies basically continuing their efforts at what I would just say very simply is mechanization. They're trying to figure out how to extract more coal with less labor to make it cheaper so that they can make more profit. And surface mining is one significant iteration of that. And after World War II, it's really increasing substantially. And that's why you see some of the first regulatory laws passed, starting with West Virginia in 1941 and then Ohio in 1947, both of which are seeing strip mining take off in that period of time. Kentucky is particularly interesting because what happens there in the 1950s, the state Supreme Court ruled that broad form deeds could allow coal operators to get minerals out of the ground if they own the mineral rights without even getting permission and without compensating the landowner. So there were these deeds that were signed in the early part of the 20th century that landowners often thought would be fine with the kind of things that they're doing in terms of using the land for farming because there wasn't strip mining. But then in the 1950s with strip mining, coal operators want to dig the coal out of the ground in a different way than deep mining. And so by the 1950s, they're doing this. They're destroying people's land. They're destroying their water, polluting their water, and in some cases, destroying their homes, like huge landslides and other residual consequences of strip mining, just sort of making waste of people's homes and livelihood and killing people, sometimes too, burying people alive. And so that's the beginning of opposition in Kentucky. And there's opposition throughout Appalachia, but if we want to today, we could sort of focus on Eastern Kentucky. And by the 1960s, people are starting to feel like it's necessary to get organized. And that culminates in 1965 in the summer with the creation of Appalachian Group to Save the Land and People, which then grows and through the rest of the 1960s becomes a model for other people to resist surface mining, but they changed their goal over time from getting state regulatory laws to realizing that those don't work to wanting to abolish strip mining, maybe getting a state law to do that, and then eventually realizing by the end of the decade that they have to have a federal law to do that, and they're starting to connect up with other groups in other parts of Appalachia by that point, including West Virginia, which of course has a member of Congress, Ken Heckler, who is the person who introduces a bill to have a federal law to abolish strip mining, which they almost achieve. And I think that's an underknown story, that we almost had the abolition of strip mining in Appalachia.
The environmental activism that you discuss, it provides a very, very important look at the role of working class in the region. And also, it's interesting, a growth of a more militant movement employing civil disobedience, community organizing, and even some sabotage. Mm-hmm. How does opposition to mining change in the 1960s and 1970s? And then and then also particularly now, why is it important to examine these grassroots efforts in order to amplify those voices?
So as I said, I think of strip mining as part of mechanization, which is about unemploying miners, right? It's about taking away their jobs. And that's something we need to remember when people say, oh, we can't attack coal because we need the jobs. When in fact, the coal companies are the ones who are trying to get rid of people's jobs. And so miners are very quickly brought into the movement to deal with strip mining because they also live in the places where strip mining is happening. So they're losing their jobs and they're seeing the landscape destroyed. And so there's a very important role for at least union members, as well as other working people in the movement. And this is why I started to work on this as my first book, because I was interested in thinking about where do workers fit in terms of the story of environmentalism. And I kind of had an idea that they are actually at the center of it because they're the ones facing the most of the problems earlier than other people. And that's counterintuitive to the way we think about environmentalism today, right? Where we usually think of jobs versus environment as a mutually exclusive choice. So in Kentucky, you have people who are deep miners involved in the movement. And so there'll be some people that would do things like, you know, send petitions to the members of the state legislature. Sometimes they'll do nonviolent civil disobedience and stand in the way of bulldozers so that they can't destroy their land. And then you have probably miners. We don't know who they were, but probably miners who know how to use explosives going on to strip mine sites and blowing up mine machinery. Nobody's ever caught for this, but by the end of the 60s, they're starting to do that. This kind of organizing for economic as well as environmental justice and using these kinds of tactics are how we would define the environmental justice movement today. And so part of the other thing that I do in sort of telling the story is to suggest that the environmental justice movement, even though we don't have the word for it, starts decades before. We usually say it starts, you know, in the 1970s or the early 1980s, and that Appalachia has an important part in that story.
We've been talking a lot about the 1960s and 1970s. And if you think about that particular time period nationally, what do you think are some similarities or maybe some differences between the anti-strip mining movement in Appalachia and then also the larger national civil rights movement?
That's a really good question. And one of the very interesting things for me about the history of opposition to strip mining is the way in which the social ferment of the 1960s infused the organizing and the way that people were thinking about strip mining in Appalachia. And to some extent, they're just hearing about it. And I mean, they're already sort of in a way radicalized by their situation, but then they're hearing about it in the news. And then what you also have happened because of the war on poverty are anti-poverty activists coming in from outside of Appalachia and collaborating with people there in Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia. And this creates a connection to other social activism of the day, not only civil rights organizing, but, you know, which employs nonviolent civil disobedience, but also opposition to the war in Vietnam, the beginnings of other kinds of more militant union activism, like the United Farm Workers in Southern California. And that helps evolve the movement. And so, for instance, by the time you're getting to the early 1970s, people in Appalachia are talking about their situation as being colonized, and they talk about what they need to do is decolonize Appalachia. And that's coming from people who are thinking about third world liberation movements, right? And so that is showing up in Appalachia even. And the United Mine Workers, of course, too, is affected by this. And there's, you know, a lot of corruption in the mine workers at state and national levels in the late 60s, early 70s. And a group within the United Mine Workers who call themselves Miners for Democracy take over the union. They win the election of 1972. And that group of people are also part of the opposition to strip mining. The union basically helps fight against strip mining because it sees the wrongs that are there. And that's, again, something that we've forgotten, that unions actually used to be on the other side of this, right?
I've thought quite a bit about activism and unionism and labor history recently, and particularly with issues that are ongoing in the region with the continued decline of coal. What do you think is the legacy of anti-strip mining opposition? And most importantly, how do these stories and some of those lessons, like you have documented, impact activism in the region today?
Well, unfortunately, one of the ways in which the movement's decline affected people afterward is that it made it harder to organize. It made it harder to convince people that they could actually make change. because what happens in the 1970s is the larger national environmental groups, particularly the Sierra Club and Environmental Policy Center, collude with more moderate members of Congress to move away from the demand for abolition. And they say, you know, what we will accept is regulation. And then meanwhile, the coal industry, of course, is trying to get the weakest law they possibly can. And together, those two things come together in 1977 to give us the Surface Mining Coal Reclamation Act, or SMCRA. And that's, you know, better than nothing, but it's not what the people, the grassroots were demanding. And it's not really what is, it's not solving the problems. And so when people fail in that, when they see people thwart their efforts like that, I think it kind of, you know, sort of nurtures pessimism. So there's a while where, you know, through the 80s where, you know, Kentuckians for the Commonwealth is established and others groups, OVEC in West Virginia, but it's not like the movement before. And we didn't really see a resurgence of militant resistance until Mountain Justice came around, I think in 2004. In a way that is much more connected, it's much more like the earlier movement.
If you are interested in learning more about this particular topic, and it's something that I do recommend everybody take a look at, I used it heavily for my own research purposes, and I've benefited greatly from your research. Chad Montree is the author of To Save the Land and People, A History of Opposition to Surface Coal Mining in Appalachia. Thank you so much for talking today. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you, Stephanie.
Stephanie Lang interviews on Eastern Standard are presented in partnership with the Kentucky Historical Society Research Fellowship Program. Kentucky has more than 355,000 small businesses. So what was it like to be on the receiving end of calls and emails from worried, distressed owners and operators as the implications of COVID-19 were beginning to sink in mid-March of 2020? Well, we're about to find out. Christina Joyce is state director of the Kentucky Small Business Development Center. It's a state organization with a network of 17 offices located all across the Commonwealth. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Christina.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure to be here.
And first, if you would, recall for us what you and your staff there at the Small Business Development Center went through, what you experienced in the early days of the pandemic.
Well, I remember quite clearly our last day in the office was Friday the 13th, in March 2020. And what we did over the weekend, because we knew the shutdown was coming. And ironically enough, that next week on that Wednesday was America's SBDC Day. So we had, and that's a celebration of all SBDCs across the nation. And so we had kind of geared up some of our technology tools to be able to do some things for SBDC Day. Well, you know, we pivoted really quickly, just like a lot of businesses in Kentucky. You know, we started working remotely. We kicked our technology tools in high gear, and we pivoted, much like all of our entrepreneurs have had to do.
I think we'll never doubt the meaning of Friday the 13th ever again, will we?
Absolutely not. It's etched in my mind forever.
When these businesses have come to you for help, what have you been able to offer them?
Well, we help companies to understand at that particular time, the COVID relief programs were coming out. And so over this past year, our business coaches have been able to help almost 3,000 business owners understand the varied COVID-19 relief programs and funding options. And we've helped them to locate participating lenders and help them to develop a plan moving forward.
Supply chain issues have been really challenging, really persistent. Have you been able to step in and help businesses deal with that?
Well, we have the expertise to help them to navigate supply chain issues and maybe create a plan for moving operations online or analyze their cash flow to help determine the next steps. We also, with our Wednesday webinars, we were able to bring in experts to talk about some of these pressing subjects that they needed answers to right away. And so that's whatever we can't help them with, we try to find the experts and bring them in and do a webinar series to help get them the help that they need and the information that they need. when they need it.
You just mentioned the Wednesday webinars. Go ahead and make a pitch for that, because I'm sure there are lots of people that like to know about it.
So I tell you, Tom, this was another thing we had been thinking about, but kicked it into high gear. It went much more quickly and became much more successful than we could have imagined. But we started the Wednesday webinars because of, you know, all the questions around all the opportunities and challenges. And so since the shutdown began, we've had more than 12,000 webinar attendees since this pandemic began.
Wow.
And what I love about our webinars is if you can't make it at noon on Wednesdays, you can go to our website, KentuckySBDC.com, and you can watch every single one that we've had since last year, since we began. So, you know, I know sometimes people, they can't do things right in the moment, but they may be able to do it in the evening or first thing in the morning. So it's like a treasure trove of information. And so they can scroll down through and they can see, oh, I need to know more about this, or I need to know more about that. And it's all there on our website. And you can also find these on our social media sites.
Well, Christina, this pandemic has given a fresh new meaning to the old saw, necessity is the mother of invention. And I'm wondering if I'm betting that you've noticed a lot of innovation going on among business owners as they figure out how to survive this thing.
Exactly. And of course, the Kentucky SBDC helps businesses to start, grow, and succeed. And during these trying times, we want businesses not only to survive, but to thrive. And so, you know, we've seen a lot of innovation come in. As you know, in the restaurant business, they had to pivot quickly because they couldn't do business the same way that they were used to. So, you know, when businesses are both facing incredible challenges, they tend to innovate sometimes. We know that there's been some casualties, but we've also seen companies embrace technology and offer new services and deliver their same wonderful product in new and more pandemic-friendly ways. So we've helped them with that journey.
Oh, you mentioned restaurants as being hit hard, and among many businesses that have taken a hit are live music venues. And I know you have some information about Shuttered Venue Operators Grants. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I don't know. We're waiting on specifics, too, and we're waiting for that to start up. But I can tell you that the Kentucky SBDC, because we saw the need for this, we have put together a team of creative economy and tourism of our experts in the Kentucky SBDC, our business coaches. And so they are keeping a specific eye on this grant, and they're helping get people ready for it. And that includes everything from, you know, artists to musicians to, you know, bed and breakfast, tourism. It all touches. I like to say it's like a plate of spaghetti. All of this touches throughout Kentucky. And so we're all kind of waiting on the details and how to get applied for that grant. The details are still forthcoming.
Now, you all have produced videos of your Pacesetter Award winners, and those are all available for viewing on your site. And I was wondering if you could give us some examples from the Eastern Kentucky region who have been winners.
Well, you know, Tom, our Pacesetter Awards, normally, you know, we have a huge celebration, and it's in Frankfort at the gorgeous Kentucky State Capitol. But this year we had to do, you know, we kept waiting to see if there was going to be a time that we could be face to face. And we had done these videos and alerted the winners. And so we figured, well, you know, we need to celebrate these folks. So on SBDC Day in March last month, we did our 2020 Pacesetter Award winners. And the two from Eastern Kentucky were Made to Crave and Total Auto Service. And what I'd like to encourage our folks to do out there is, you know, check out our website, KentuckySBDC.com, or our Facebook page, and you can see these beautiful videos of these amazing people and their small businesses, and you can hear the stories straight from them. And I hope you had some time to view them too, Tom, because they're quite inspiring.
Mm-hmm. I have, and you're right, they are. Christina, we are nowhere near out of the woods with this pandemic. And just wondering what you're anticipating. What's ahead for the Small Business Development Center?
Well, you know, Tom, I'll have to tell you, when the pandemic hit, we had 12 business coaches, and we knew that that was a problem for 120 counties. We knew we needed to expand our capacity. And so we, you know, applied for some CARES Act funding through the Small Business Administration and was awarded that. And we were able to hire more business coaches. And so now we have 33, and we hope to hire about three or four more. And they all work together. I like to say, if you get one of us, you get all of us. But the workforce that we have now, we have folks who have experience and background in all kinds of businesses, all kinds of different types of education. And so again, you know, no matter where you are, if you're in, you know, London, Kentucky, and our business coach in Paducah has what you need, our business coaches work together as one to get you what you need when you need it. And that philosophy, along with technology tools, have really, really helped because there are no boundaries. Travel's not not a burden anymore. If you need to talk to someone, we can do, you know, either phone or Zoom. And we have a business planning platform that's virtual, so you can actually get online with your coach and go through your business plan together and make changes. It's just super cool. So I like to say that out of challenges sometimes comes great ideas and great opportunities to leverage innovation. And so once the pandemic, let's hope and pray it's behind us sooner than later, as the Kentucky SBDC continues to grow and expand throughout Kentucky, we're going to not just put our tools down that we use through the pandemic, we're going to add them in addition to in-person, online, virtual, because I think that'll help us to reach more people. And that's what we want to do, Tom. We want to reach all the small businesses in Kentucky.
And how do we find you online? What's your address?
Our address is KentuckySBDC.com. Or if you're more of a phone person, you can call 1-888-414-7232. And again, if you're a social media buff, all you got to do is look up Kentucky SBDC.
All right. That's Christina Joyce, State Director for the Kentucky Small Business Development Center. And we thank you so much, Christina.
Thank you so much, Tom. We so appreciate the opportunity. You take care now.
You too.
Thanks.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett our producer, Neil Kesterson our producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine our studio dog. Want to suggest an interview or a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.